Hey everyone, this is Graham from Guru Focus. If you haven't met me already, I run our Value Investing Live series on YouTube. The podcast you're about to listen to was originally recorded live in front of an audience, so our guests may make references to charts and PowerPoint slides that you won't be able to see here. If you want to check out their full presentation, including those slides, or join our next live stream, click on the link down in the description. Now back to the podcast. All righty. Welcome, everybody, to Value Investing Live. We are proud to present Dave Sather, founder of Sather Financial Group, and the guest of our 1,000 Entrepreneurs series late last year. Dave and his team celebrated their 20th anniversary last year and currently manage approximately $850 million in assets. For the fourth time in the last 5 years, the firm has been named a Financial Times Top 300 Registered Investment Advisors. His students at Texas Lutheran University have won the Texas Investment Portfolio Managers Competition for the last 3 years in a row. Just keep in mind, you can post your questions in that chat section throughout the entire time. Granted, all of those questions will be held until we get to the very end of Dave's presentation here in a moment, and then we'll go ahead and jump into our Q&A session and we can answer all of those questions as they come up. Other than that, I'm going to hand the floor over to Dave here, and we'll go ahead and let him kick things off for us.
Cool. Let me see if I can actually enable some technology here. All right. Everybody see my title screen? Graham, is that good?
We got you.
Excellent. Well, welcome, everybody. I am flattered to be asked to speak at the Guru Focus Conference. I've known Dr. Charlie for an awfully long time now, and it's just fun to see Guru Focus's success and to benefit in the process. I've been in this business almost 30 years. I started in 1992, and I certainly have seen some interesting times during that tenure. And my goal in sharing today will be to identify some of the landmines that we have blown ourselves up on, as well as give you some tangible ideas that we currently own in our portfolio, and then maybe leave you with a couple of portfolio management tips, and then we can open it up for questions. So thank you, everybody, for taking part of your day to be here. So as we think through ideas, I certainly remember this coming out of graduate school. You know, everyone's got a plan, and then something weird happens, and Mike Tyson punches you right in the nose. And I know I've been guilty of this, but people go, oh, you know, what kind of investor are you? Oh, well, I'm a value investor like Warren Buffett. I hear lots of people say that, and I really kind of wonder what that means to different people, because I think it's actually morphed and changed over time. And the conversation we've had in our office is, you know, we're part value investor, part growth investor, part momentum investor. And at the end of time, we're investors. We're all looking for value. We're looking to add value to our clients' portfolios. And I don't think that you can just say, I'm a value investor. Warren Buffett has been so misquoted over the years that he is a value investor, and everybody automatically puts that in a nice little square box, and the world just doesn't work that way. Buffett has repeatedly said over the years that growth and value are attached at the hip, and I think you've got to give equal parts consideration to both of those facets to become really an accomplished investor. I also realized that given the time frame that I actually came into the business, greatly affected who I was and certainly how I started. You know, I came into the business in 1992, and between 92 and 97, I was the smartest guy in the world. I didn't understand what was so difficult about this business. We made 30% a year for the first several years. And you know, you need to take a step back and not confuse genius with a bull market. The market was really strong. The market was going up 30% a year. If you threw money up in the air, you generally did well. The problem is none of us really know how good we are until we really get punched in the face. We experience the tech wreck of 2000, $146 a barrel oil. We have the 08-09 decline from banking and the housing crisis. The S&P dropped 65%. And of course, all of us are experiencing a pandemic. And I think until you've been through some of those things, you don't really know who you are as an investor, and you haven't really had your thesis really tested to figure out whether or not it's going to work the way you expect. So getting punched certainly causes you to take a step back and to try and identify what you don't know. And that's probably one of the hardest things about being younger in your career, is that you don't necessarily intuitively know where the thin ice is. I know that was certainly the way it was with me. And if you don't know where your blind spots are, how do you really know what you understand? And so Buffett always says, hey, look, stick to your circle of competency. Well, when you're young in the business, and even myself after almost 30 years, your circle of competency is probably pretty small. And to keep yourself from blowing up, you need to focus on a small circle of competency. And as you do, you look for businesses that are typically predictable and consistent. That's usually the way that we go about it. Certainly with my students, I ask them, if a business is not predictable and consistent, then how can you logically make an assessment about the future value of that asset? If you're going to try and figure out what's the value of Bitcoin, what's the value of gold, what's the value of oil, we start factoring up, writing down in black and white, what are the variables that really matter in making that assessment? I know that, you know, we live in Texas, we're obligated by law to have an opinion about the price of oil. And I can tell you, no matter how many times I've thought about the price of oil and whether or not it's a good investment, there are always too many variables for me to make a good decision. And so really taking a step back and trying to identify those key variables is very important. So when we didn't do a good job of identifying what really mattered, it caused us to chase after a lot of junkier assets, things that made things way harder than we really should have. And either I've gotten lazy in my old age, or maybe a little bit of wisdom, maybe it's a combination of the two, of getting beaten up. But the older I get, the better I am at just saying, I don't know what the answer is, but there are easier answers that are out there. So playing opportunity cost in our minds relative to our portfolios. And I think in the process, you really need to be very humble. I know that I am surrounded by people that are smarter than me every day. And so asking for their wisdom and their counsel is important. Asking questions and then sitting back and listening, because you will learn something from everybody in your circle. Just recognizing somebody on any given topic is always smarter than you. You are never going to be the expert in the world on a given topic, most likely. And if you are, it's in such a narrow focus that you need to call upon experts in other areas. So, in kind of walking through some of the traps, this is something that we do the first week of every year with my students at Texas Lutheran. I always ask them, what's your favorite American car company or favorite American sports car? Inevitably, somebody says the Mustang, the Camaro, and the Corvette. Those are pretty easy. And I've got to say that the Mustang GT350, it is just absolutely a really cool race car. You may have had a great experience with an iPhone or maybe with some other service or a product or whatever. Does that unique experience with that mean that it's a good investment? And that's an important thing to conceptually think about. If you've ever taken the time to look at the balance sheet, income statement, and cash flow statement of Ford and GM, you would never invest in those assets. Maybe you would think that you could time it and trade it, but I know I can't. So the point is, familiarity with a product does not necessarily translate into a great investment. Here's a great chart on Ford's price. You can see that they have just struggled mightily over the last 20 years. They're just, again, easier decisions to make. I can like driving a Ford, but I don't have to invest in Ford. And the same thing can be made for just tons of companies as well as industries. Just remember, you don't have to invest in everything. You don't have to figure out everything that works, because some things are just really, really difficult, and the success rate is very marginal. CMEX is probably a really good example of one that we stubbed our toe on. We owned CMEX back in the early 2000s. We liked the fact that every cement plant and factory is essentially a little regional monopoly. Mining and shipping cement is very capital intensive, but it's also very heavy. And as a result, it limits the number of competitors that you can have within 100 or 150 miles because of the distribution costs. So it was something that we developed a level of comfort with. It was a tangible asset that we could get our minds around. Easy to understand mining out cement and then refining it and shipping it out plus or minus 100 to 150 miles. But then CMEX decided they wanted to go and do something really intelligent. They made a massive acquisition at the peak of the housing market in 2008. Their debt increased by $16 billion at the time. So it was 2.5 times increase, with the assumption that things will always be good. And if we were great as a pretty sizable player, we must be super great as a huge player. And then they were so convinced with their wisdom and their logic, they stacked all of their debt maturities, or the vast majority, like 80 or 90% of them, to all come due in 1 year. And what they didn't realize was they had sold their fate of the company to the investment bankers for the terms to refinance and renew that debt. And it really put them in a precarious position, and that was before factoring in the downturn of the market. So little X there, that's when they took on all that long-term debt. And you can see that it was kind of a pig in a python type situation. They took on all that debt. They bought Rinker. They thought everything was going to be great forever. And basically for the last 15 years, they just struggled to work off that amount of debt. And this is what the stock price has done. So the X again identifies when they took on that debt. You can see that the stock price has never recovered from having the burden of the massive Rinker acquisition, having to deal with all that debt, and then a massive downturn in your industry. So when we study companies, debt is the number one killer of good businesses. And especially in the market today where interest rates are so low, a lot of people are very tempted to take on an awful lot of debt. Should also remind us that even a good business with a wide moat can be a terrible investment. Those two do not necessarily go hand in hand. Because again, management can do some really dumb things that will really blow up your investment thesis. Citigroup and AIG, knowledge and understanding. I am fully responsible for making this bad decision. And basically what it was I came out of the banking industry prior to starting our own firm. I thought I had a familiarity with those businesses, and they kept going up. So a lot like gold or Bitcoin or lumber today, just because something has gone up in the past doesn't mean it's going to continue to go up in the future. And that was something to where it was kind of a FOMO situation, fear of missing out. Oh my God, Citigroup's going up. AIG's going up. But I didn't know what the trigger was that would tell me that something had changed. And there were some really big triggers with both of these assets. In the case of both of these, they had huge derivative books. And if debt is bad, derivatives is multiple levels of bad. And then you had counterparty risk as to whether or not the other person on the other side of that derivative was actually going to be good for the money. And then ultimately with those big investment banking houses, you're investing in a black box. There's just a massive difference between investing in a community bank that lends out money and takes in deposits versus an investment bank or just out and out gambling. And really, if we look ourselves in the mirror, at this point, we were just gambling. We were hoping that these assets would continue to go up. And we didn't know why it would stop going up. And we didn't know to get out in time. Fortunately, it didn't completely crush us. So hopefully we've matured. And instead of talking big at cocktail parties, we started to try and just understand small things on a regular basis. And it really helped to improve the way we saw the world. And that led us to paying up for quality. And this is a constant conversation that Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett had in the past. And it was Munger's influence on Buffett that really converted him from being a cigar butt investor. And I have to admit that we chased after a lot of things that quantitatively were cheap, but at best they were probably a cigar butt, or we didn't understand what the triggers would be. What we've come to find out, and this was Munger's influence on Buffett, quality buys you time. And that's the one thing an individual investor has these days. They can spread their time frame out. Wall Street, they want to have a great return in 1 year or maybe 2 years. We sit down, we tell our clients, we're making this investment for where we want to be 5 to 10 years from now. So just know that having control over timeframes, that is your investing superpower. And then for you to be patient as an individual investor, it's really important to understand that with Warren Buffett worth $75 or $80 billion today, after giving away $30 billion, 95% of his net worth has been accumulated after age 60. I'm not age 60. I'm looking forward to accumulating that 95% of my net worth as I age and as I become better as an investor. So the other thing we like about quality type businesses, you can be wrong and still be okay. So you can pay too much and that asset will grow into a longer term valuation. And so we try to be more approximately right as opposed to precisely wrong. Generally, even though we run a variety of math models, it needs to fit on the back of a cocktail napkin. It needs to be that simple. Finally, the better quality ideas, they lead to less turnover, which improves your tax efficiency. So Buffett started accumulating Coca-Cola in 1987. His adjusted cost basis is like $2 a share on a stock that trades for 45 or 46 bucks today. He's paid zero in taxes on something that's gone up 22 or 23x over the years because he chose wisely to begin with, good quality asset that he could hold on to for the next 30 plus years. So the type of things that we are looking for that we own today, we own every one of these, railroad, something like Accenture, Visa, MasterCard, Microsoft, Brown-Forman, the maker of Jack Daniels. I always laugh that Accenture is my favorite business just because it's done the best for me personally. My second favorite investment is MasterCard, and the best time to buy MasterCard is any day that ends in the letter Y, because no matter what's going on, it seems like MasterCard finds a way to continue to grow and do really well. These all ought to be very familiar businesses to everybody, good quality brand names, often with just absolutely rock solid balance sheets, which allows them all to survive and do really well in tough times. So what we've realized is that with really boring ideas, a lot of our clients will say, you know, well, why aren't we investing in Bitcoin or the latest, greatest competitor to Facebook or Amazon or things like that? The value created by boring ideas, it spends just like really exciting ideas, except I have to get less variables right to make the boring ideas work. Success is a lot more about being disciplined and doing disciplined things with great consistency over decades. What we have found is our clients just cannot handle the volatility. When they see swings of plus 50%, they can't handle it and they don't know what's going on. So it's the same thing that Joel Greenblatt, running his hedge fund, when he was earning 34% a year, his clients just could not handle the volatility. And that's why he's changed some of his investment strategies to tamp down the volatility. And this kind of leads us to our mantra or our goal. There was a story told by Steve Romick, the investment manager of FPA Crescent, in which he was talking about the investment manager for an insurance operation. So he managed the float. And he was the most boring guy ever on the planet. He was never on the cover of Barron's. He was never top quartile, but he was also never bottom quartile. So for 30 years, he was just slightly above average. And after 30 years, his track record placed him in the top 4% of all of his peers. That's what I want. I want to be in the top 4% after 30 years. I don't want to be number one for 1 year and then I blow everybody up. To me, that is the worst kind of success. I want to make sure that I can look all of our clients in the eyes and make sure that they are always going to be kept in the game. Because if we've owned good quality things, even if we stub our toe, we can earn our way back out of it. So Unilever was one of the ones that I said that we own. It is by far one of my favorites because it's really easy to understand. It's a wide moat business. It's got more than 100-year history. It sells food and beverages, home care items, beauty and cosmetics. See, that's about as boring as it gets. But they sell to 2.5 billion people a day in nearly 200 countries per day. They're a huge beneficiary of the emerging market. And as people move up into the middle class, they have greater spending power and they want to buy better quality brand names. So Unilever is there to provide vast majority of the emerging markets this big scale and consistency, but yet they partner with local economies, whether it be Vietnam or Malaysia or Indonesia, and they really custom tailor the product mix to cultures and customs that are important to that dynamic. The other thing that works by having local partners, they serve as a wonderful barrier to entry. So you end up with local control, better growth, and very high returns on equity as well as on invested capital. The Union Pacific Railroad, you know, in March, as the pandemic was really roaring, and we didn't know what the outcome was, we knew that volumes would be down on the railroad, but I never once thought, oh my gosh, I wonder whether or not Union Pacific is still going to have 33,000 miles of track. I never wondered whether or not their cars were going to evaporate. They have got a footprint that cannot be duplicated because nobody would ever put up with them putting a rail line through their town, their backyard, whatever it might be these days. Better yet, this is a green technology. And I think a lot of people just don't understand the technological evolution that is happening in a lot of very old businesses. But whenever you watch a train go by and you see double stacking of those container units, that makes them more efficient. More importantly, once you get a train up and moving, if you don't have to stop it, momentum basically carries it from the East Coast to the West Coast or vice versa. So what has Union Pacific done? Well, they've double tracked, triple tracked, and in some cases quadruple tracked. So their trains are as efficient as possible and never have to stop going one way versus the other. When you compare Union Pacific, as well as the Burlington Northern Railroad, owned by Berkshire Hathaway, our largest holding, you see they dominate all of the long distance traffic west of the Mississippi. West of the Mississippi is where the majority of the growth is in the United States, and that's also where the most distance is, which allows Union Pacific to deliver better efficiencies overall. MasterCard, obviously, it's one of my favorites. It's a wonderful wide moat toll booth. And yet they're helping. When I go to a store, I always expect that they're going to have MasterCard available so I can just swipe my card. And then that business wants to be able to connect directly to their bank immediately and then send me a nice statement at the end of the month going, hey, yeah, here's what you owe. It's all good. Does it all look great? Nice accounting for me. That in itself is such a fantastic network effect. But consider this. Somewhere between 77 and 80% of the world still uses green paper money of some sort. Nobody likes that. Businesses don't like it because their employees steal from them. Governments don't like it because it costs a lot of money to make paper cash. And it aids in tax evasion. So if everybody is swiping, there's a better accountability of how much money is actually going through the economy. MasterCard's also been a wonderful beneficiary of the pandemic digital divide. As everybody's staying at home, everybody's ordering their groceries online, we're swiping that card. Every time we go on Amazon, we're swiping the card. When you've got a business that is this dominant and it still produces return on equity and return on invested capital of better than 40% a year for the last 10 years, it should get everybody's attention. Facebook. Sometimes you got to look in the mirror and just go, Dave was wrong, and I am the first one to admit that I dug my heels in. I don't like Facebook. I don't like it when people get on there with their political tirades and tell me everything I never wanted to know about their life. I don't care what they had for breakfast. I don't need to know that they had a bean burrito. However, in the middle of the pandemic, we all took a step back, and the team that we've got, they forced me to learn a whole lot more about Facebook. And what we recognized was it was a bunch of really smart people with software connecting the world. And if there was ever a time to be able to easily and seamlessly share information, it was in the middle of the pandemic. And instead of having to build more factories or bring in more steel or concrete or things like that, what we had to do is plug in another server and we could add another 100 million people onto Facebook's platform. So, you know, you take a step back and just at the most functional level, It's the middle of March and the world is shut down. You're running a local restaurant and you're trying to communicate with the world. I'm open. Here's my menu. Here's my hours. Here's my special of the day. Where's the first place you're going to go to tell that story? It's Facebook. It is so obvious. And that's what I had to finally get over, that there were so many positive benefits despite the things I don't like about Facebook. So it's been a huge beneficiary of the digital divide due to the pandemic, as well as just society. So as you break it down a little bit more, we love the fact that the inventory, the content, is contributed by everybody who posts on there, which is fantastic. Facebook doesn't have to contribute anything in the way of inventory. It's got the highest operating income per employee out of all the FanMag names. It's pretty cool. 38% EBIT margins and $50 billion of cash just sitting on the balance sheet. So compare, you got Facebook, $50 billion, Microsoft, Google, and Berkshire Hathaway, all having somewhere between $50 and $150 billion of cash on the balance sheet. In every case, that's just ballast that allows you to carry through a very stormy time. All of that said, Facebook today doesn't even take into consideration all the good things associated with their partnership with Shopify, which really probably gives a mom-and-pop entrepreneur a fighting chance to compete with the big guys and probably presents a legitimate threat to Amazon at some point. It also partners with the emerging middle class. So the emerging markets, as they develop that middle class, more and more of them are going to do business with Facebook. In fact, in many emerging markets, if you ask them what the internet is, they will tell you Facebook is the internet. That's how ubiquitous it is in their minds. And of course, then there's mobile penetration too. So lots to like here. Sometimes if we are just a little stuck with an asset, maybe we're not quite sure we want to sell it at today's price or buy it at today's price, we'll use put and call options. And we really find that instead of being a great moneymaker, it's a great mental discipline to just step back and say, at what price would you buy this security, or at what price would you sell a given security? And so we'll use cash secured puts to increase the cash flow to a portfolio. It's very easy to get 5%, 6%, 7% cash flow at a time when interest rates are at basically zero. So it forces us to identify an acceptable entry point, but it also improves the cash flow, which is really important to our clients that are trying to live off their portfolios. Really good examples, Oracle. Earlier in the summer, Oracle was trading at about $52 a share. We were struggling with that asset because we recognized there was a lot more financial engineering going along with it. And so it was stable, but slow growing, trading in the low 50s, took out three tranches of call options. And once you added in the call premiums that we get to keep no matter what, it gave us exit points that will expire in September to get out of that position at 55, 58, and 60 bucks a share. It was a great way of continuing to collect the dividend off of Oracle, and it has continued to be a fairly slow-growing asset, and I'm sure some of our Oracle will be sold next month. In the meantime, the rest of it, we'll just continue to keep it and probably duplicate the strategy again. Of course, in a situation like this, the risk is the price can just get away from you. You should have just bought it in the open market or just sold it in the open market. Those are the risks that you have to try and figure out in your own mind relative to this strategy. Then there's also things like cash out arbitrage that we'll do. So we hold a pretty sizable position in Tiffany. Tiffany is being bought out by Louis Vuitton. Louis Vuitton is buying them out at 135 bucks a share. It's a friendly merger, so we don't engage in hostile takeovers. And Louis Vuitton actually took the very unusual step of going out to the capital markets to borrow money at a negative interest rate so that they could fund the Tiffany purchase. We've never seen anything like that before. So today you can buy Tiffany at like probably 125 bucks a share, and we think this is going to close sometime between now and the end of the year. So that's somewhere, you know, $10 on $125 stock, you're getting about an 8% gross rate of return on that. The closes in the next 3 or 4 months, you're looking at something like a 30% annualized rate of return if you do it right. So you do have to be careful. You do have to be patient because sometimes these deals blow up. We've had a couple blow up on us, and we just had to be really patient with them. Cooper Tire is a really good example. Cooper Tire was going to be bought out by their management. They had the cash. It was a friendly deal. We thought, man, this is great. Except Cooper Tire had a Chinese joint venture, and the Chinese got really mad that they weren't consulted on the deal. They locked down the factory in China and would not let the management leave for 3 months. Not kidding. True story. That obviously shows a difference of law between the United States and China. Obviously, that deal fell apart, and we ended up having to hold it for probably a year and a half before we got back out of it. So sometimes, all the research in the world, something really weird comes up. NXP and Qualcomm, that was another merger that's been in the news within the last couple of years, and the government just stepped forward and said, sorry, there's no way we're going to let this happen. We had been a buyer of NXP around 90 to 100, and it was supposed to be bought out at 125. It fell all the way down to the mid-70s, and it fell all the way down to the mid-70s again during the pandemic. But NXP is a good business. It's not our typical, predictable, and consistent type business, but it's allowed us to be patient with it and work our way through it. Then there are just issues of portfolio management, and we recognize there's just not that many great companies out there. So on any given day, there's probably 5,000 some odd companies that trade in the United States, but probably only 250 of them, maybe 200 of them, ever are on our radar screen for a business we would actually own. So we really want to focus on our best ideas. And then once we sift through those 200 companies, probably only something between 15 and 25 are actually going to make it into a portfolio. That forces us to really take a step back and say, if you're not willing to put 4% into a given name, why do we want it at all? It needs to be one of our best ideas. Again, opportunity cost. And it forces us to really know our portfolio at a very high level too. And then ultimately, instead of, you know, just selling out of something, a lot of times we'll scale up and down that portfolio. Sounds a lot more scientific than it really is. It does force us to kind of own the same names and then focus on the valuation as we sell out at the high valuations and recycle that money into our lower valuation names. It is as much art, if not more art, than it is science. And then lastly, I'll just say, you got to surround yourself with people that are willing to be brutally honest with you. Everybody that I work with, they are better than me at least one thing, if not many things. I am probably the least gifted person on our team intellectually. And I love the fact that I get to pay them to punch me in the nose and say, no, Dave, you're wrong. And here's the reasons why. If I am willing to accept that beating, which I need to, it makes all of us stronger as a cohesive unit because we all work together in our portfolio management skills. And as we have interns that are coming up, I want them to understand what it's like to think through these things and to say, we are in pursuit of intellectual honesty. I don't want my ego to get stroked. I want the right names to go in a portfolio. So that forces us to push each other, forces me to stay on top of my game, forces all of us to be accountable at the end of the day. So that said, that's kind of my 25 plus years of wandering in the wilderness and kind of how we've gotten where we are. That said, I'm more than happy to open up to any questions.
All right. And I know we did some last minute shuffling, Dave, on getting that computer set up. So we might be changing the original plan here. So I plan on feeding you these questions.
No problem.
Looks like before we even kick things off, right when we were getting started, we had a couple questions of whether or not you actually use Guru Focus. And I think based upon some of those charts that we saw there in the presentation, you do in fact use Guru Focus. But what would you say would be your most favorite features or tools, or, you know, how do you use it in your day-to-day life? How does it work for you?
Yeah. Truth be told, I have been friends with Charlie Tien, the founder of Guru, almost since his very first time. I mean, he was still working for another company when he started this. And at the time, we were compiling 13Fs by hand, and we noticed that he was doing it. So depending on what we're trying to accomplish, We will use 13Fs to just try and compile other ideas. There's certain managers that we know what to expect out of them. And so it's a great way of kind of narrowing the investment focus. We will use the discounted cash flow just to run a variety of different scenarios and figure out if we're in the ballpark or not. There's a lot of good articles on there that allow us to just read and stay up. But the data, 30 years of financial data is fantastic. And, you know, I think my students probably think that I contrive a lot of these things in my head. But, I mean, we really use this stuff professionally. I will go to 30 years of financial data on Guru on a daily basis because I just want to look at the data. And a lot of times the data is telling you a story that may not be readily apparent. You know, sometimes you can see that earnings per share were negative, but cash flow was really positive. Okay, we'll go track it down and figure out what happened. You know, it's a maze that tells you a story. And if you're willing to look at the data, so much of it is right there in Guru Focus. And so I've just always appreciated the fact Guru Focus has always helped my students at Texas Lutheran University also. And it's a cornerstone of their program as well as what we do.
Absolutely. And we appreciate the kind words of that. All righty. So, looks like another question here. Would you say that value investing is dead in the age of quantitative easing? And can you really find value opportunities in the expanding monetary quantitative easing that we're seeing?
Yeah, it's a difficult question. So, I'll try and answer that in two parts. 100 years ago, the top companies in the world were steel companies, oil companies, and chemical companies. 50 years later, they started to become technology companies, but it was things like Eastman Kodak and Polaroid. And today, the top companies they didn't even exist 25 years ago. And I think that the way that value investing, as it has traditionally been applied, has changed. You know, looking for things that are cheap on a price to tangible book value basis, I'm just not sure it has as much meaning today. When I can buy something like Google or Facebook and take the free cash that's been accumulated and set it to the side and take the time to actually understand what the business is, I never would have thought that I would be sitting here saying, yep, I can actually invest in Google. And I understand the value parameter. I'm not going to say it's a traditional half a book value type thing, but I'm not sure that's the way that you should value an asset like that. And on any of those, especially if they're producing just large amounts of free cash flow, I think you need to take that free cash flow and set it to the side and figure out what you're actually paying for the underlying business. So I wouldn't say that value investing is dead necessarily, but the way that academics apply the definitions, it certainly appears that way. But go back to the very first slide. Buffett has said value and growth are attached at the hip. At the end of the day, we're trying to buy good quality assets for less than the future value of their cumulative cash flows. So that will change. It continues to change. 10 years from now, we'll come back. It'll have changed. 25 years from now, it'll come back and it will have changed again.
Definitely.
Let me add this, Graham. The whole quantitative easing situation, you know, to quote Charlie Munger, if it doesn't confuse you, you obviously don't know what's going on. It confuses the hell out of us. We don't necessarily know what the outcome is going to be. And as a result, we try and build even more margin of safety in. But it has certainly compressed interest rates and made us have discussions that provide as much intensity about concepts like deflation as well as inflation all at the same time. And the honest answer is we don't know.
For sure. And on a note of seemingly a trending topic lately, especially with some of Buffett's portfolio changes here in the last couple of weeks, do you have any stance on gold or silver or any real estate, anything like that?
Yeah. So commodities are just difficult to value. If you want to make an argument for silver, I can see that because there's some industrial application for it. Gold is probably a reaction to world chaos. And certainly if the world hasn't been chaotic lately, I don't know, you know, under what rock you live. But I don't believe that that was actually Warren Buffett who bought that. I think it was probably Ted Wessler, Todd Combs. And that is me coming back and just saying there's easier decisions to make. So I don't know about Bitcoin. There's enough issues with Bitcoin to where I just take a step back and say I'm not sure I understand it. I see the commercials, and this is a fairly frequent conversation we have with clients is, you know, should I buy gold? Gold is a better alternative than green dollar bills, but productive businesses, I still think, are better than gold.
Gotcha. And when you're creating when you create a portfolio from scratch or when you've done it in the past, what are the first steps that you take? Do you use the Markowitz techniques or anything like that?
Well, we spend an awful lot of time just thinking about businesses, number one, that are predictable and consistent, something that has some sort of a competitive advantage. And again, if we don't understand it, we're not going to do it. And full disclosure, we own Facebook and Google today. We did not own them coming out of 08, 09. And it wasn't because we weren't aware of them. It's just that they did not have that predictable and consistent aspect to them. So first, you're just trying to figure out qualitatively, can you understand that asset? And then you're trying to figure out, is there a way that I can reasonably model out future cash flows? And do I think they have a competitive advantage going forward? I think you can probably model out some range of future cash flows for Exxon or Chevron, but I don't want to own something whose underlying product is a commodity and it's expensive to get it out of the ground. And then I've sold my inventory. It's really expensive to go replenish it. Those are things that I think I can probably project out. So I can probably get a good value on Exxon or Chevron, but I'm not sure that the growth is there. And that's before factoring in crazy people in Russia or the Middle East or things like that, that may completely turn that entire industry on its head. So that the conceptual starts, and then we start trying to build our math models to say, okay, are we okay buying this? If it falls, do we want to buy more of it? And are we content to let this thing grow for a good long while?
For sure. And what are your thoughts on buying a stock at a high share price with the long-term goal of using market corrections to do tranching, it looks like, to reduce the cost basis?
So I as far as like a stock's price, I mean, we're looking at the underlying value. And conceptually, we're trying to figure out whether we buy one share or 100 shares. Act as if you own the whole company, because I think you'll take a longer approach. I can tell you that there's a lot of concern about partial shares and stock splits and things like that. And again, every time that Wall Street comes up with a new innovation, it's generally another clever way of separating the average investor from their money. And so if you're buying partial shares and you're buying more partial shares, just understand that you're probably getting front run on that trade. It may only be costing you an extra penny every trade, but there are certain firms that are more than happy to help you with that. So they may bump the bid-ask spread. They may front run the trade. They may be the market maker and manipulate the bid-ask spread. A lot of those things can happen. And so for us, we are only trading in very large numbers on behalf of our clients, but it applies for an individual. You need to be using limit orders. You need to be very careful and thoughtful about what is the price I am comfortable paying for this given asset. And then if it falls, precipitously, revisit your thesis, run through all of it again. If it falls and you're not willing to buy more, then you need to have a long conversation with yourself.
For sure. And when you're valuing a stock, would you say you look at free cash flow or earnings or a combination of both?
So we will spend a fair amount of time looking at revenues, operating cash flow or operating earnings, net income, as well as free cash flow. Because even if all of those line up, it probably tells you something about that story. But again, like I referenced before, if we see that cash flow is way high and net earnings are way down, okay, something happened. Let's figure out what it was. And is it something to be concerned about? Again, there's just tremendous value in the data. And if you don't understand what the data is telling you, you're missing an opportunity to understand something. Again, just going back to Facebook and Amazon, Berkshire Hathaway, are you really paying up for $150 billion of Berkshire Hathaway that's sitting on the sideline that is not needed to run those businesses? So you can do some accounting work to set that asset aside and then figure out what are you really paying for the cash flow, future cash flow, in the operating earnings, in the revenues, et cetera. So I think you've got to look at all of those to really develop a complete picture or as complete as you can.
Gotcha. And it looks like I'll go ahead and lump two of these questions here together and a large question for you, if we want to call it that. And what would you say is the most effective method to get the intrinsic value of a cyclical company like Tesla? And what would you say your thoughts on the current price of Tesla truly are?
So I have written articles about what a horrible investment Tesla is, and I've been wrong the whole time. And I have to admit, this is another time where I'm probably wrong. And I think everybody takes the position that Tesla is a car company. And I'm not sure of that anymore. I actually think Tesla is a technology or a software company. And I'll give you a good reason why. And that helps to answer the question as to whether or not Tesla is cyclical. It may end up with a different trajectory, more like Microsoft or Google or something like that. But the other day, they had a press release talking about their Model S. And when that Model S, whatever model it was, what year it was, did 0 to 60 in like 3.6 seconds, which is blindingly fast in the first place. But with a software upgrade. So think about that. We get software upgrades on our phones and our computers every single day. Just with a software upgrade, all of a sudden they got better efficiency out of the batteries in the car, and the car now goes 0 to 60 in like 2.4 seconds because they tweaked the software. That tells you that Tesla's not in the business of selling cars. They're in the business of selling software. It just happens to be that some of us used to buy floppy disks, and that's how the software was delivered. Elon Musk is delivering his software in a car. So it fascinates me. I don't know if I can value it. I admire what he has accomplished, and we welcome him moving his truck operation to Texas. But at the end of the day, I'm not sure that I can figure it out as well as I can the Union Pacific Railroad or Starbucks or Jack Daniels.
For sure. And looking towards a company like WeChat now, which has been a successful all-in-one platform in China, do you see a similar platform becoming the future of payment and media in the U.S.? Looking at stuff like your positions in Facebook, things like that?
That's a really good question. My gut reaction is the answer is no, because of the antitrust scrutiny that those companies are already getting in the United States. I think the antitrust people are elected leaders. They would absolutely have a conniption fit if they thought about, you know, a combination of Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Microsoft all combining to be one. That doesn't mean that some new fintech operation couldn't build something that grows into that, but I still think you run into antitrust issues. And at the end of the day, I mean, make no mistake, the Chinese stole that technology from us. They just happened to package it all together. And when you've got your government blocking and tackling for you, you can get away with that. So I, again, different playing fields. I'm not sure that I want to invest in that. If you saw the news this morning, State Department is telling, I don't know why they started with universities, but telling universities, you may want to dump your Chinese stocks because you may not be allowed to own them anymore in the United States. So when I see things like that, it makes me take a step back and just say, there's easier decisions to make.
For sure. And do you think the recent fall in price of Intel and Cisco presents an opportunity for all the value investors that are watching here today?
Probably, but I can tell you for myself, I'm not sure I know enough about Cisco's network switches or Intel's chip design. So like NXP, that is one of the things we have struggled with. We own NXP. We understand conceptually why it works. We own Qualcomm, which makes chips. We understand why that works. But it does seem like both Cisco and Intel are kind of falling out of favor and becoming maybe more a commoditized type technology. I can't see, number one, something that I understand. Number two, something that allows them to maintain their competitive posture. And so it's just easier not to do it.
Gotcha. And what would you say your opinion on Wells Fargo is right now?
Yeah, so in addition to coming out of the banking industry, I am chairman of the board of a bank in Texas. I followed banking very, very closely. Fortunately, we sold all of our Wells Fargo about 2 years ago. I don't know. It doesn't surprise me that Buffett is trimming back because of the reputational issues. He is generally a big believer in, you know, backing people that are honest and have integrity. And I'm not sure that Wells Fargo has that. The CEO that they now have came from Bank of New York Mellon. He's a very well-respected person, but he's still got a hard road in front of him. You've also got issues like, you know, the PPP loans that were issued after we entered the pandemic. Wells Fargo is considered to be a troubled bank currently, and they were not allowed to participate in those. So when you've got a government regulator that's saying, sorry, you guys have shot yourselves in the foot so badly so many times, we're not going to let you help people, it should get your attention. And again, I think there's easier decisions to make. I know on the investment side, a lot of investment advisors have left Wells Fargo Advisors to either go out on their own or go somewhere else. Those are just really hard tides to stem and get them to turn around. I think Wells Fargo is probably going to do it. It's just going to take time. And again, getting back to it, favorite discussion that we have in our conference room table, would you rather own Wells Fargo or Dollar General? Wells Fargo or MasterCard? Wells Fargo or Visa? Wells Fargo or Jack Daniels? You know, when you put it like that, it really cuts to the chase very quickly and just go, yeah, there's a lot of things with Wells Fargo. I don't know what the answer is. And that's before we start talking about interest rates coming down as far as they have and compressing the net interest margin that is traditionally the bread and butter of how banks make their money. So for us, we don't want to go there.
Gotcha. And let's see here. Looks like we got a question here regarding what your discount rate is.
Yeah. Again, something we struggle with. Going back to the question about quantitative easing, this will help to answer part of that question too. For a long time, we had a ratio that we would follow to modify our discount rate relative to the 10-year treasury, relative to where we thought Buffett would probably set it. And then interest rates kept falling. Our discount rate today is 9%. We've kept it at 9% for a long time. The 10-year treasury has continued to fall and fall and fall. You can just be very intellectually deceitful with yourself if you sit there and go, well, it doesn't quite make it with a 9% discount rate, but if I lower it to 5%, it looks great. You know, I mean, fun with math. Liars can figure and figures can lie. You've got to understand the business, and you've really got to understand what is a fair rate of return. 9% may be way too punitive, but I actually think it's really forcing us to focus on things that we're really most comfortable with, as opposed to reaching. Every time I've reached for an investment idea because I wanted it to be true, I've blown up.
Gotcha. And any opinion on USA GDP versus the market valuations?
Yeah, they're really out of whack. I don't. Obviously, it's not just GDP. You have to look at unemployment. You have to look at the rest of the world also. And I also think you have to look at not only our stock market, but you also have to look at the FANMAG names, because they're the ones that have done really well. There's some other stocks that have done well. So again, Brown-Forman, Dollar General, Union Pacific, those have done well. But for the most part, the average stock has not done well. And I think that is much more indicative of the fact that there's still 11% unemployment. And it is definitely a concerning issue. Not that we're trying to make macro calls, but depending on what happens with the second round of bailouts and checks that get mailed to everybody, you know, if people stop spending, we need to remember that 70% of GDP is consumer spending. And Dollar General, it may be one of the greatest companies on the planet, but if people don't have any money to go there and spend, it doesn't matter. And so we've got to do something to bring unemployment down. We've got to do something to get people working again, because I'm not sure that the average business is actually that strong. And I think our GDP is fairly weak. As a side note, if anybody reads Howard Marks' stuff, in one of Howard Marks' recent commentaries, he admitted that he was confused about the decline in GDP the most recent quarter, because it was down like 33%. That was actually the annualized decline in GDP. So it was more like 7-something percent in the most recent quarter. So again, fun with numbers. You got to be careful about what we're looking at. I am just hopeful that we get a cure for the coronavirus and better treatments. And I think we're actually a long ways in on getting the treatments, but I think it's still going to be some rough time in front of us.
For sure. And we are starting to bump up against our time limit here. And we do have a lot of questions pouring in here. And as we previously mentioned, as we previously talked about, Dave, and I'll just let our viewers know now, granted, we do have our time limit set around an hour here, but we are going to keep track of all these questions. Dave does want to answer all of them if possible, and we will find a way to get all of these answers out to you guys, whether that be in the comments section or if we put something together on Guru Focus as well, just so we can get in, you know, good answers to all those questions out there.
Hey, Graham, for what it's worth, I'll stay until you're done, so I've got more time. I know you've got some other commitments today too.
For sure. So if it comes down to it, at the very least, likely we'll head to the comments section, and we can also work together on compiling a potential for an article on Guru Focus that we can feature you on as well.
Cool.
And getting down, let's see, we've got to get a little picky here for questions. I guess a good one for everybody here that I think will be a good wrap-up for our time here. Would you say that now is a good time to start investing in international stocks, or would you say domestic?
So I'm thank you for the question. This is a huge pet peeve of mine. There is no such thing as an international company or a domestic company. Again, this is crap. Sorry, this is garbage that is being taught either by Morningstar or the academic institutions. Is Facebook a U.S. company? And does Facebook make 100% of its revenues in the United States? No. Facebook gets 54% of its revenues outside the United States. Most of the companies that we look at derive about half, if not more, of their revenues outside the United States. So, I mean, the definition of what is a U.S. versus a foreign company, that is a concept that just makes zero sense anymore. You need to spend the time to figure out where the revenues come from. That is what's most meaningful. So Unilever, Unilever has two listings, one in the Netherlands and one in London. It gets 80% of its business outside of North America, even though it trades here. So it's not a U.S. company. We like that. But, I mean, it's spread all over the globe. Same thing with Microsoft. You know, I just, again, spend the time looking at where the revenues and the earnings come from. Getting back to currency type questions or relative relationship between currency and gold, I want to own a business that sells, again, like Unilever, into 200 countries every single day. Because whatever currency is acceptable and in demand is what they will pay for services with. And then Unilever can add all that up and go, here's what we earned. And so, again, I work with some of the world's largest investment consultants. And this is a question I have for them all the time. Why do you continue to, you know, slice and dice the assets this way? A mailing address is not where you make your money. A mailing address is something a lawyer did for you 100 years ago. So figure out where the revenues are derived, figure out where the earnings are derived, and that will just tell you a lot more about the business. I want a business that has a product that is in demand worldwide and can sell to everybody. Why would I intentionally want to exclude part of the world just so that I can say, we're a U.S.-based company? That's the most arrogant, stupid thing I've ever heard.
For sure.
You can thank a lot of academics for that concept.
Definitely. All righty. Well, we are at the end of our time limit here today. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on, Dave, and I want to thank you for coming on, sharing your depth of wisdom with all of our viewers here, and for being a Premium Plus member with Guru Focus at the very least. It's been an absolute pleasure. We really do appreciate everything you've done with us and for being a longtime fan and supporter of us.
Not a problem. It was a ton of fun, and if we can compile the questions, if you'll take the time to submit a question, I will make sure it'll get answered eventually.
Absolutely. And on that note, for any of you viewers that haven't had your questions answered yet, feel free if you'd like to. We'll be posting a full recap of this in case you missed anything or want to go back in those slides. We'll have that full recap posted here on our YouTube channel shortly, as well as linked on Guru Focus. You can repost those questions down in the comments section on that, which will make it an absolute guarantee that we see them. But for sure, we'll be copying all of these questions out of the chat here so that we can get answers from Dave. And we'll be putting that out for everybody to see later so that all of those questions can be answered in their entirety. Other than that, once again, thank you so much for joining us today, Dave. Everybody in the chat's very appreciative of having you on here, and it was a great presentation from you.
Thank you, everybody. Have a great day.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to this episode of Value Investing Live. If you haven't joined one of our live streams before, check us out on YouTube and register for the events on gurufocus.com. If it's your first time hearing of us, click the link in the bio for a free 7-day trial of Guru Focus, where you can test out all of our great tools and features. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.